session number 21560, wheel 5.
Mr. Gretton, reel 5.
And after they had, or as they were actually going in, we had in the, oh, I remember we were being shelled, the shells were getting closer and closer, and I remember the CO, not Ryder himself, but the CO of this landing ship headquarters saying, I think we should move out a teaspoonful, I always remember the remark. And so we did move out of range. But then as they were going in, there were a whole number of rocket craft. I'd never seen rocket craft before. And one of them, as you know, a rocket craft is in a series of what looks like upturned railway lines, and row after row, and they go off one row after another and are supposed to blanket with explosive the shore at which they're firing. One of these rocket craft started firing towards us, and it was all the rockets were going short, and line after line after line, or row after row, were exploding closer and closer and closer to our craft, until the next craft to us, which I suppose was what, 25 to 50 yards away, was completely obliterated in explosive and what looked like white steam, white smoke, was all that was left on the surface of the sea. And I thought, and I presume everybody else on our craft thought, well, the next one will get us. As what luck would have it, it happened to be the last row of rockets. And so we were spared. So I thought I was extremely lucky. We were extremely lucky to escape that. In my book, I've talked about this and about the whole business of being scared and what fear means and so on, and the fact that there was an actual VC standing beside me when this happened. So that was Volca, and I think I have read that 70% of our craft were damaged or lost or damaged in that assault. I then, I got back to Brussels. Oh, the next thing was Brussels. I got back, I got ashore, and from Breskens, I got a lift to Brussels. I somehow or other got put, I was invited to a dinner in a very posh flat, which belonged to a Belgian Navy, Royal Belgian Navy officer, who was some relative to Belgian royalty. So we had our dinner, whatever it was, and afterwards we were sitting around, and I heard what I had already heard in London, so I knew exactly what it was, and that was a buzz bomb. And apparently it was the first one to come over Brussels. My instinct was to dive under the table, which I, of course I couldn't do in front of in front of these my hosts. They were curious and went to the French windows and opened them out and went on the veranda to look at this thing. And as I say, as soon as I heard the engines cut out and I knew the thing was diving, it was all I could do not to dive under the table. Anyhow, I didn't. And they came back and discussed it. But they had no idea that of the danger of these things. That's all I can remember about Vorkeren.
What's all this about a submarine called Shakespeare?
After that, I was attached to the British East Indies Fleet, the BEIF. Went out to Colombo in a troop ship, and one of the first things I did was to go to Trinco, where the submarine Shakespeare had just come in after a very dramatic duel, both with a Japanese armed merchantman and with Japanese Air Force planes, bombers. And my photographer then, Charlie Trusler, took some very dramatic pictures of the huge great holes in this submarine. And again, I did the story. The interesting thing was that after she was very badly damaged, almost crippled, in fact she was crippled, she never went to sea again, and she was limping back to Trinco, she was met by another submarine, which was very cagey as to when they started exchanging signals and asked for the CO's name. His name, I think, was Swanston. So he gave his name, and he said, my wife's name is so-and-so, and your wife's name is so-and-so, just to make absolutely sure, because they happened to be friends, and their wives happened to be friends. And so that sealed their bona fides. Then there was a whole story about how the one of the chief petty officers manned a gun and fired with a machine gun against the attacking aircraft, and so on and so on. It was a great story. That was one thing I did. What I did then was to go out on operations, various sweeps with destroyers. We went as far as Sumatra, the Maldives, and so on. One of the earliest operations was to the island of Chiduba off the Arakan coast. I was on the cruiser Newcastle, and I remember comparing the assault craft which we were in with the assault craft on D-Day, and all the assault craft was the kind of whalers with the, well, they weren't whalers, but they were wooden craft with a outboard motor, and I thought how exposed we were as we chugged into the shore, and to my so this again was a Royal Marine show. It was another all naval show, and there was a brigadier in command. I won't give away his name, but he was always known, apparently, as Brigadier Hiccups. And to my surprise, we were all dished out with rum to give us Dutch courage, apparently, because this certainly never happened to us on D-Day in Normandy. We're all given, as we were chugging into this palm-fringed island, we were given rum. And I kept on thinking, well, what the hell am I supposed to do when I do get ashore? I mean, all I've got is a notebook and a pen. If the Japs are still occupying this, and there's still, of course, there was terrific bombardment from the cruisers to start with, which was supposed to soften up any defence. Anyhow, We actually landed, and not a shot came against us, not a shot, not a shell, nothing. And everybody landed on the sand. And I should point out that I hadn't been given a new uniform for the Far East. So I was still in my khaki uniform that I'd had, of course, in Europe. I went ashore with the Marines, and I'd gone a few paces inland. I remember seeing a big shell hole, which had been made, of course, by one of our own guns from the cruisers, and poor wretched Burmese corpse at the bottom of it. And I'd just about seen this when there was a loud shout from the brigadier, "Who is that man giving away our position?" Because I was in khaki uniform and not in the bottle green battle dress, as they called it. And so I was ordered back to to this boat. So that was the rather anti-climax of my first operation in the Far East. The next was Rangoon, Operation Dracula, which was also a bit of an anti-climax, because we it was unopposed, and the Japanese had actually pulled out before we got there, though we didn't know it. And well, there's not very much to story to tell about that, really. And soon after that, my war ended. So my war ended when we went on a. We did, yes, we did a whole number of things, but my war ended when I went on a sweep in Sumatra. And again, by an extraordinary coincidence, we sank some Japanese craft, again with the Nubian, which was another tribal class destroyer, and which had been with us, in fact, in Namsos. And after we'd sunk these Japanese craft, we were on the way back. And I was on the bridge of the Tartar. I was on the Tartar, and the Nubian was astern of us. And there was complete cloud cover, unbroken cloud cover, grey cloud cover. And without any warning, there was the unmistakable swish of a bomb, which came and near missed our bows. Very, very close near miss. I didn't even have time to drop to the deck as I started to do. And so, really, this was why I call my book Full Circle, one of the reasons, because just as after Namsos, and on the Griffin, there had been this. Well, this was the third bomb, really, that I'd missed, because the two on the Afridi and one on, which near missed the Griffin. Exactly the same thing happened again in the Far East, and that was the last thing which happened before I spent the rest of the. Well, it was after the war, of course, until I got back on a troop ship. And I think I was actually discharged in June 1946.
How do you feel now about having served in the Navy in the Second World War?
Well, until I I've never kept up any connection with the Navy. I've not followed up any ex-service. I haven't joined the RNVR ex-service or anything at all until I wrote my book and at least two chapters of it, in fact the two main chapters of it, deal with the Norwegian campaign and with the, of course, with the evacuation from Namsos. Now, all the books which I've read about this campaign quite naturally deal with the military or the naval aspects of it. And I wanted to get a Norwegian civilian dimension to it. After all, the wretched Norwegians had to put up with the invasion, with our intervention, and with 5 years of occupation by the Germans. And I thought it was only right that the Norwegian civilians and what they went through should come into it. I eventually managed to get in touch with the local historian at Namsos, a chap called Jens Anton Andersen, spelled with S-E-N at the end. I spoke to him on the phone, and to my delight and amazement, he said, "Oh, I'm coming over to see you." And sure enough, he flew over, and he spent a weekend here with me. And he not only provided me with a whole number of exactly what I wanted, information about what happened to the civilians in Namsos, but I took him to Hyde Park, and I showed him the boulder just north of the Serpentine, which is a memorial for the Norwegian seamen, both merchant seamen and Royal Norwegian Navy, who lost their lives during the war. And it was during this walk that he told me, and he kept on repeating it afterwards, he said, "You know, in Namsos, the French have had a memorial there since 1957. And every year on Norwegian Independence Day, which is May the 17th, the French have sent over a deputation and they've had a little ceremony at their memorial." And he said, "The British have had not only have had no memorial there, they have never sent any deputation to take part with the French, and there is absolutely nothing in Namsos to show that the British even took part in the Norwegian campaign, far less the fact that we in fact had three times greater number of casualties than our allies." And he said, "We simply must have a memorial in Namsos." And he didn't ask me to do anything specific, but the implication was there. And after he left, I got in touch with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission and also with the British Legion, and both of them, for one reason or another, said that they had no intention of having another memorial at Namsos, for having a memorial at Namsos, another one in Norway. And to cut a long story short, I managed to get an appeal going and a fund going, and we raised the money. And sure enough, on May the 17th, 2000, 60 years after the war, the British ambassador unveiled a memorial at Namsos. And there it is. And again, a year afterwards, on its first birthday, again, I took over a party, only four of us, six of us the first time. And we had a little do at the ceremony. That's what is actually written on the boulder.
It says, in memory of the British casualties suffered in His Majesty's ships, Afridi, Maori, Grenade, Bitten, Carlisle, Aston Villa, Arab, Gaul, Rutlandshire and St. Goran, and in the Hallamshire Battalion, York and Lancaster Regiment, King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry and Royal Lincolnshire Regiment in the April-May 1940 blitz and evacuation from Namsos, as well as the unknown Royal Air Force pilot who died in 1942. On the other side, facing the church, is inscribed in Norwegian, in memory of the British Army and Naval Forces who died during the Namsos campaign, April-May 1940. They died so we can live in peace, freedom and democracy.